From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. And for Jeremy Hobson, it's Here and Now. And we're going to get straight to Europe, where the migration crisis is being called the largest mass of people on the move since World War II.
And that is the sound of hundreds of migrants protesting outside the main rail station in Budapest, Hungary, after that country suspended all rail traffic from that main terminal to keep migrants from traveling through the European Union. The International Organization for Migration says more than 330,000 people have arrived in Europe this year, many of them fleeing the civil war in Syria. The BBC's Bethany Bell just left the train station in neighboring Vienna, Austria, where those migrants stuck in Budapest want to go to get to Germany. And Bethany, do you think that Hungary stopping the trains was in part in response to Austria, which said, you know, you just can't put these people on a train and send them to us? What are you hearing?
The Hungarians have severely criticized the remarks by the Austrian chancellor about this. They say that this is creating dangerous pressure, if you like, on the subject. But this is an argument which is going on throughout Europe. And what the Austrians are saying is that the EU's asylum system is clearly not working. The idea that you are supposed to request asylum in the first EU country you reach is clearly being breached in Greece. It's being breached in Hungary. It's being breached here in Austria. We're told from Austria to Germany, around 1,400 people a day crossed over from Austria to Germany throughout August. So it's clearly not working. And what many countries are calling for, Austria and Germany included, is for the EU to figure out a common way of approaching this problem. And they're suggesting that the burden of refugees has to be shared out with a quota system.
Well, meanwhile, describe the scene that you saw at the Vienna station, the end of the train line for the people who'd been, the migrants who had been traveling from Budapest before it was stopped.
Well, last night there were dramatic scenes at the station. Hundreds who had been camping out in Budapest for so long were finally able to get on trains. They arrived in Vienna. Police telling us that more than 3,000 people arriving in Vienna from Budapest. A lot of them, though, didn't stay in Vienna. They jumped on other trains going north, heading to the border with Germany and on through to Munich.
So many moving through. But what's expected to happen to those who don't? I mean, we know people are always moving around the globe, that there are always places for migrants in many countries anyway, normally. But what's expected to happen to these people?
If a refugee claims asylum in an EU country and they have not previously claimed asylum in another EU country, they will get the right to stay here. It's more problematic for people from other countries, countries in Africa, for example. There are certain countries which the EU says people definitely have the right to protection. And people aren't arguing that. They know that they will look after those people. However, there is the sense of when do these flows of migrants and refugees stop? And how many can countries continue to take in? Germany is expected to get 80,000 requests for asylum this year. That is a lot of people. Austria, which is just 8.5 million people, is expecting 80,000 people to apply for asylum this year. It is an enormous problem.
And just to be clear, is Syria considered a country from which you can get refugee status if you flee?
Yes. The question is then there's the internal bureaucracy in the EU as to which country should take them.
What do you think is going to happen next? You have the trains being held in Budapest. Also, we understand on the roads, the backups in Austria are, you know, for miles because, of course, you had the horrific scene of the 80-plus migrants found suffocated in a small truck, and officials are now looking through trucks. So what do you think happens next?
I was down at the border yesterday. I saw police opening the backs, searching through them and finding people. A woman in a headscarf carrying a tiny they escorted by the police over to a makeshift Red Cross shelter, which is there on the border. And the police are really trying to crack down on people smugglers here, because the discovery of that truck with the 71 people who died on in the back of that truck has really concentrated the minds of the authorities here. And they say they want to prevent further deaths.
Well, so you have up to 12-mile backups of traffic. You have trains that have been stopped. It feels as if this migrant crisis is coming to some sort of a tipping point.
It's a sense of crisis. I mean, people keep coming. The leaders don't have solutions, and yet more and more people are on the move throughout Europe.
Bethany, thank you. The BBC's Bethany Bell in Vienna.
And now to Alaska, where President Obama is hiking a glacier today. The trek is to draw attention to the visible effects of climate change. Last night, the president spoke at the International Arctic Conference. He said the world is not acting fast enough to stop this crisis.
I've come here today as the leader of the world's largest economy and its second largest emitter to say that the United States recognizes our role in creating this problem, and we embrace our responsibility to help solve it. And I believe we can solve it. That's the good news. Even if we cannot reverse the damage that we've already caused, we have the means, the scientific imagination and technological innovation to avoid irreparable harm.
That's the president speaking last night. Journalist Elizabeth Arnold is covering the president's visit from Anchorage. Elizabeth, today the president is going to talk about the need for the U.S. to send more ice-breaking vessels to the Arctic seas. Currently, the Coast Guard in the U.S. has just 2 working icebreakers in the Arctic. Russia has 40. The president says the U.S. needs to up its numbers of icebreakers. What for?
Well, the reason is so important, and that is with less sea ice, there's just so much more vessel traffic up here. I don't know how many Coast Guard officials have said to me how they don't get any sleep at night. It's become sort of the standard response to questions about safety concerns. And seriously, there are adventure travelers, cargo ships, even a major cruise line is planning to transit the Arctic, and there's not much in the way of search and rescue available. I've been on Russian and U.S. icebreakers out there, Lisa, and the traffic is growing exponentially. And in addition to the icebreakers, the White House is going to announce an initiative to better map the Bering, Chukchi, and Beaufort Seas, and basically that's the Arctic Ocean that borders Alaska, and for an observing system to monitor sea level rise and ice thickness and that kind of thing. And this is all much-needed infrastructure when you consider that right now the only heavy-duty vessel with icebreaking capability is like 1,000 miles north of Barrow right now, near the North Pole on a scientific mission, and the nearest deepwater port and major Coast Guard bases hundreds of miles in the other direction. So the administration's recognizing the need up here to do more.
And access to the Arctic is an international issue. The president, I know, spoke last night to the State Department-sponsored International Conference on the Arctic. What did he say?
You know, it was interesting as an Alaskan and as a journalist to listen to the speech. It was this bluebird day outside, and we were in this dimly lit convention hall, and it was so dire, and it painted such a dark picture of living here because it was so focused on the consequences of a warming climate. The tone is clearly urgency, Lisa. The president didn't stray at all in his message that it's almost too late. What's happening here is a harbinger of what the rest of the world can expect. You know, it was sort of like coming to a theater near you if you don't do something and do something quickly, which is a measure of his determination to building momentum for consensus and action at the upcoming climate negotiations in Paris. You know, he said this year in Paris has to be the year the world reaches an agreement to protect the one planet we've got. There was a lot of that kind of rhetoric in the speech. There's such a thing as being too late. The moment is almost upon us. It was pretty negative, actually, but that's the message.
I wonder how much credibility he can speak with the president when he admits that the U.S. is partly to blame for the problem of global warming. I mean, he said the U.S. is the second largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world. So when he speaks to world leaders, does he have a lot of credibility?
Well, I think the credibility comes because he's standing there saying, and we are here to do something about it.
Another thing the president's doing on this visit is to do some hiking. He's hiking Exit Glacier. What's the significance of this particular glacier?
Well, he's going to the coast today to Seward. It's a small fishing town, and he's going to take this hike on Exit Glacier. And he urged other world leaders to do the same thing in a speech yesterday. And then he heads out on a boat in Kenai Fjords National Park. So it's a very scenic, glaciated area. It's a big photo op, Lisa. It's basically, I mean, it's going to be gorgeous today. It's going to be a beautiful photo op. But he'll be talking again in dire terms about what's happening and that these places are disappearing and the ice is melting. Tomorrow he goes to Dillingham, where the White House knows it'll be warmly received because it's the home of Bristol Bay, the world's largest wild salmon fishery, and the president recently put it off limits to oil and gas drilling. So he's going to be a kind of a hero there. And then he heads north to the true Arctic, to Kotzebue. It's above the 60th parallel, the Arctic Circle. So that's where he becomes the first sitting president to set foot in the Arctic. And he'll hear there from local residents in a listening session at the school. And Kotzebue is mostly Inupiaq Eskimo, and so it's where he'll start hearing from people who, on the one hand, are experiencing firsthand the effects of extreme weather, but on the other, want to share in any revenue that might come out of oil and gas activity offshore in the Arctic.
Elizabeth Arnold, covering the president's visit for us in Anchorage, Alaska. Nice to talk to you.
You too, Lisa.
When last Robert Redford was on our radar, he was on a solo journey in the middle of the ocean, battling the elements and personal demons aboard a slowly sinking sailboat. It was, of course, the film All Is Lost. In his latest film, A Walk in the Woods, the journey in jeopardy is a hike along the Appalachian Trail with Redford battling age, a bear or two, and sometimes his hiking partner. In Walk in the Woods, he plays one of our favorite authors, Bill Bryson. In real life, Bill felt something missing, decided to hike the 2,200-mile-long Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Maine against his wife Catherine's wishes. Here's Redford with Catherine, played by Emma Thompson.
It's just something I feel I have to do. I want to explore nature. I want to get back to my roots.
Roots?
Yeah, you know, push myself. I mean, really, really hike.
Can't you just do this in the Volvo?
Catherine.
Then enter Stephen Katz, played by an almost unrecognizable Nick Nolte. Stephen Katz was a real friend of Bill Bryson's, and off they go. A Walk in the Woods is based on Bill's wildly popular memoir. It opens tomorrow, and Robert Redford joins us from KRCB in Santa Rosa, California. Hi.
Hi.
Watching the film, I found myself thinking, wow, it's as if Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid were getting older and wanted to test themselves on a hike. And then I read that you were thinking of a reunion.
You mean with Paul?
Yeah.
Paul Newman, yeah. That's how it started about 15 years ago, maybe. I read Bryson's book while I was on vacation. When I read it, I thought this could be the next installment or possibly the final installment for Paul and I to do another film together. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, when I got to Paul, he loved the book. He loved the whole idea. But he said, look, Bob, it's been almost 20 years since we did the last film together, which was The Sting. Mm-hmm. And time is taking its consequence. And physically, I don't think I could get up there and do this. And at my age, I think the age difference between you and I, which was about 14 years, would be too extreme.
Well, you would have been around 65, Paul Newman, almost 80. And he may already have known he had cancer. He died in 2008 at 83. So you bring in Nick Nolte, he of the red face, shortness of breath, his character on the lam from the law. Why Nick Nolte?
He's smart and he's relatively undisciplined. At least he has been most of his life. And that seemed to fit the bill for me. So I finally reached Bill Bryson and he and I met and he couldn't have been more generous. And he said, look, you just do what you want. I said, is there any restrictions you have? He said, no. He said, I trust you. I've seen your work. Just go do it.
But then Nick Nolte, as you said, oh, my gosh, here's a scene. Let's just listen. Here's a scene where your character sees him for the first time in decades. Bryson and he really were a kind of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid traveling through Europe when they were younger. But Katz has not aged well. He's alcoholic, a mess. Let's listen.
I gotta eat every hour or so. Otherwise, I get these,
What, episodes?
No, they're...
Seizures?
Seizures, that's right.
You get seizures?
Mm-hmm, yeah. You know, I ate some contaminated peanut thiamines about 10 years ago. I'm totally jacked up my system, you know.
I thought you said you were in shape.
I am.
And so it begins. Just talk a little bit about that. Was Nick Nolte really in that bad shape, or what happened there?
He was in pretty bad shape, but he had a very strong heart and a strong will, and he said, look, I'm going to do this. And we did, you know, we didn't hike the whole Appalachian Trail, but we felt like we did because we would hike sections that were going uphill, and because it's film, you do one take, then you go back and do it again, then you do it again. After 6, 7, 8 takes, you're really pooped. So we had to do that over and over and over again, and it was a real test of his stamina and his capabilities physically. And he came through it really, really well because he's a real professional.
You mentioned that, okay, it was physically taxing. There's a hilarious scene where you and Nick Nolte are hiking. You sit down, you're completely out of breath, pooped. You're about 100 yards from the start. You haven't really gotten anywhere. But Bill Bryson in the book was in his 40s, so he was questioning his physical shape. You're approaching 80. Is there something else that's going on for you emotionally? Like, wow, I used to be able to do this. You know, you had the skills that Bryson didn't have.
I did. I guess, first of all, I was an athlete in most of my young life. You know, I thought the best training is to be outdoors doing something that's real. And so that's pretty much how my life was. And so I was in reasonably good shape because of that. But you still had the age issue. So you decline. All your physical capabilities decline with age. And then you have to start doing something you never thought about before, which is kind of sad, which is you have to start being careful. Mm. And that was something that I never really thought about. But when you get older, you have to think about it.
How do you feel about that? I mean, I will go further. You say you were an athlete. You are also a symbol of American virility, I think it's fair to say. And you're putting yourself up on the screen with a face that shows your many years and experiences and wisdom. How do you feel about getting older?
I don't think about getting older. I just think about continuing. I do feel that you carry your life with you, and I never wanted any work done, surgery or anything like that. That's for other people. I should age as I am, and the characters I play in a film should age as I do.
Well, and so you're okay with it's a Robert Redford playing a character who's struggling to keep up, struggling to achieve a certain goal, questioning himself. That's okay.
It is okay. And to further answer your question, I never did look back. Through most of my life, it began with, okay, make the most of what you've been given and take it as far as you can and keep pushing yourself and move forward. You'll hit snags, you'll hit bumps, you'll hit potholes. But keep moving forward. Don't ever stop and do too much contemplating about what it's all meant. The past is behind you. Move forward. So I've pretty much been that way most of my life. So therefore, it's kind of weird when you get to a place. If, say, for example, you see an old film of yours on television or wherever, you might be in a hotel lobby and there's a clip in the background. You go, oh, geez. And you look and you say, well, that was 30 years ago. That's kind of weird because you're not thinking about that. You're only thinking about where you are now. Occasionally, you're kind of forced to look back, which is kind of tough because you haven't spent much time thinking about what's behind you rather than what's ahead and how can I move forward to face what's coming.
Yeah. Most of us don't have to see our younger selves walking past a television screen in an airport. We don't have that. Well, it's interesting because this thinking about time is reflected in the movie. Let's listen to a scene. Here you are again talking to Katz, Nick Nolte, about rock formations on the trail. Let's listen.
See, what we're talking about here, Katz, is time. Geologic time. Hundreds of thousands of years of enormous shifting tectonic plates. It's like the world being reborn from below while it's being eroded from above.
Yeah, well, when we get back, I'm going to buy you a TV. Because nobody gives a damn about shifting tectonic plates.
Well, I do. You know why? Because I'm curious and I love being curious. I like knowing things about the world or reliving it.
And Robert Redford, I just want to play you one other clip from one of our program's interviews with Bill Bryson. And this seems to be his thinking completely. Let's listen to Bill Bryson talking in 2010.
I'm not an adventurous traveler. I don't like lying down and sleeping on hard floors and getting malaria and doing all those things that real travelers do. But the one thing I do have in common with real travelers is I am really curious to find out what's around the corner, what's over the next hill.
It sounds like what you were saying. What's over the next hill? Still, do you think that way?
I do. That line wasn't in the original script. I put that in as a kind of a personal note because I am curious. And sometimes I can drive people around me a little crazy because I'm curious about things they're not. And it seems like maybe a little bit of a waste of time. But I had to deal with the fact that I've been kind of propelled in my life by being curious and wanting to follow the curiosity to some sort of a solution of some kind. And so I decided I put this line in the film because it won't offend Bryson because he is that. Mm. And one of the things about him, and I felt that moment captured it, was that he is an incredibly curious man. If you look at the body of his work, it goes in so many different directions. And what it says, what sits underneath it, is this is a very curious man who's going to stay curious. He's going to follow his curiosity to some kind of solution. So I can identify with that, and I felt that should be put in the film. And that's what that scene is about curiosity.
Yeah. Well, given that, what's next? Do you have a next?
Well, there's several what's next. This film is coming out pretty quick. And then just several weeks later is another film I've made, and it's called Truth. It's about Dan Rather's fall from grace. It's about that moment when Dan Rather, who was at the top of his game as a broadcaster, was fired by his employer, CBS. Mm-hmm. So that comes out in October.
So that answers the question. I mean, you certainly are not. I mean, it's tough to walk the Appalachian Trail, it's said both ways here on the East Coast, but it's tough to walk it. You're still walking it. The metaphorical one.
Yeah. Well, why not? I mean, I remember when I was younger thinking, I never want to be the guy that sits on a stoop in Florida in a rocking chair, rocking back and forth in retirement, and suddenly snaps his fingers. Oh, I miss doing this. I miss doing that. I should have. I could have. I didn't want that moment to come. So the way to avoid it was to just keep moving.
Actor, director, Sundance founder, environmentalist Robert Redford, his latest film, A Walk in the Woods. Robert Redford, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Still sad that we can't see Paul Newman and Robert Redford again, but Nick Nolte, a revelation. A Walk in the Woods opens tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now.
It is September 1st, but it feels a little more like Groundhog Day. Stocks in the U.S. have taken a tumble today. That's after equity markets in Asia closed lower. The Shanghai Composite dropped more than 1%. Earlier today, China released data that raised more questions about the health of its economy. We're going to look into the markets now and a tech story that we're following with Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Lisa.
Investors are hoping for a less wacky week than last week. What's happening?
Well, no such luck. We had calmer sessions last Friday, and we had a pretty calm day Monday. But traders, they're now experiencing volatility again. And some real signs of turbulence returned right at the start of trade this morning. In China, there's a gauge of nationwide manufacturing activity, and that fell to more than a six-year low in August. And that appears to be what prompted this. And you also had Christine Lagarde, she's the managing director of the IMF. She said on Tuesday that her organization expects global economic growth to weaken and that Asia risks slowing further. And that's because of the recent volatility in the financial markets.
All right. Well, let's hope there's a turnaround as there was last week. I want to get to another important business story as well, though. Starting today, Google's Chrome browser is going to begin blocking Internet ads that use Adobe Flash. That's the technology behind a lot of online video and banner ads. Can you explain what's going on, Jason? And even more importantly, whether we're going to see fewer pop-up video ads.
Whether we'll see fewer pop-up video ads, well, you know, they're pretty good at getting those ads out in front of you. But you know, Google Chrome made a decision, all right, Flash, enough of Flash. We've been using it for so many years, pretty much since the dawn of Internet video. It's powered a huge portion of online banner and video ads for really 20 years. But Google says that that format increases page load speeds, and it really hurts battery consumption on our smartphones. And so they're going to pause Flash ads by default within their Chrome browser. So that means users are going to have to click on the ads to have them play. Can't imagine that there are too many people who are going to do that. It's all about trying to push Flash out of the way and move on to greater things, a better format, what they consider a much better, what it seems everyone considers a much better format, HTML5.
Okay, and Apple is involved as well in a larger story here. This week, Apple announced a plan to make it easier to block ads on iPhones and iPads. So all of this is leading up to people opting in or out of ads, as you say, probably more out than in. So how are websites selling ad space going to make money?
Well, it's interesting. You know, with Apple, and Google's not happy about this, Apple's new operating system, which is due out as early as next month, is going to allow users to install apps that prevent ads from appearing in their Safari browser. And you know, the digital media industry, they're becoming more and more worried about users blocking online ads entirely. That's how most of them make their money. So putting these ad blockers within reach of hundreds of millions of iPhone and iPad users, that could be really disruptive to what is a $70 billion annual mobile marketing business. What is the alternative? Well, you know, Apple's not going to be blocking ads within apps themselves. And so much of the content that we receive these days actually is within a news organization's app and so, or other types of apps. So that those types of ads will be safe for now.
Okay. Jason Bellini of the Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lisa.
Last week, I was flying back from a visit to Utah on Delta. We were in the air, and I just ripped open the large bag of peanuts that would be my only food for 5 hours when the pilot came on and said, "We have a person with a serious peanut allergy on board. Would you please wrap up any peanuts you have and tuck them away in the deepest part of your carry-on?" or words to that effect. I panicked. I actually brought the peanuts back to the stewardess, realizing that in so doing, I'd exposed people throughout the plane. Would I be sending a child into anaphylactic shock? Then 2 days later, Jeremy got a text from a friend who heard the same in-the-air announcement on another flight. What's going on? Is this new policy? Well, it's definitely a campaign by our next guest. Leanne Mandelbaum's son is severely allergic to peanuts. She started the website nonuttraveler.com and advocates for changes in airline policy like the one apparently Delta undertook on my flight. And not everyone is happy. Leanne joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on today.
And Leanne, Forbes reports that one airline did change after you couldn't board with your 9-year-old, Joshua. This was United Airlines?
Yes, the change is not really one that I am happy with because basically they used to do nothing. So you couldn't get an announcement. And now what their policy says is in some circumstances, they will. So the issue with this, as with so many other airlines, is that how do you know? You know, is it going to be the crew that will make it? Who's making the decision? Who will make the announcement? Is someone in corporate making that decision? Is someone at the gate making the decision? How can you book your ticket not knowing which crew you're going to get, which gate agent you're going to get? So it's progress. It's from nothing to something. But I still do not feel comfortable.
Well, let's explain what happened to you. You were boarding with your child in Denver to go to Newark, and the gate agent said the crew would not make an onboard announcement about your son's allergy, which contradicted what you'd been told when you called United before boarding. You did ask. That's what actually spawned this whole movement that you started, this website. But explain to people who may not know, what would happen to your son if he inhaled the dust that comes off peanuts as dust comes off all foods from somebody else eating them on the plane?
You know, for me, it's more about being careful as far as the contact goes. Peanut protein is particularly robust. It can last. There's a study out there that says up to 110 days, and it's still robust. So if you have a small child or even an adult, how many times do you put your hand in your mouth?
And your point is you could put your hand on an armrest where somebody had just eaten peanuts.
That's right. And now it's in your system, you know. So not everyone who has a food allergy has an airborne allergy, although there are many. And I have reports of children going into anaphylactic shock from inhalation.
And explain what that is. What happens?
That is where you basically, your throat closes down. My son, who's now 10, he described it as somebody strangling him and please get the arms off his throat and please don't let him die today. It's like you're choking to death, yeah. But you can't remove the object.
Yeah, it swells up. There's itchiness. There's rashes. Their lips can swell to double their size. But most important, they're not able to breathe.
Yes.
But we are seeing now that the policies for the airlines are all over the place. Some are
they
much
are.
Better than others. Remind us.
You know, Delta, if you notify them, they will make an announcement just like you heard. We only fly JetBlue. Personally, they do not serve peanuts. They have tree nuts in, I think, one or two of their snack boxes, but they are for sale. So it's not something that the entire plane gets. And they create a buffer zone. So one row ahead of us, one row behind us on both sides of the plane. And they will ask the people in that area not to take out any nut product. And they also make sure that we pre-board and are able to clean the area, because you really have to clean down the light switch, the armrest, the tray table, any place your child could really touch, the seatbelt.
Well, this is pretty remarkable. You are pushing for things like buffer zones and for announcements on air for people not to open peanuts and for pre-boarding so that people like you can get on and clean the plane. This is a lot of work to travel with someone with a peanut allergy. What do you say to people who say, and they do say it to you, I understand from your blogs, that you're also causing so much trouble by traveling with someone with a peanut allergy that you shouldn't?
I would say put yourselves in my shoes. We do deserve, just like anybody else that has a disability, to be able to travel safely. What about when a family member is on their deathbed or there's a funeral that you need to attend? Or I've had a story on my website of a military family. And, you know, he gets his orders from the DOD. They need to travel. Flying's the only way to get there on time. Here he is willing to sacrifice, you know, his time, his energy, and quite frankly, what may end up being his life for fellow American citizens. And these fellow citizens find it hard to give up 2 hours flight, 5 hours flight without a nut. I mean, how is that okay? You know, if it was your child and there was rat poison, you know, on the school playground, like, what wouldn't you do to keep them away from that? And, you know, it's one thing on the ground, but when you are in the air and you're 35,000 feet from medical care, once you have the EpiPen, it's not all over.
Now, let's remind people, the EpiPen is, it's like a vaccine.
An auto-injector. Yeah. So there's, right now, there's the EpiPen and the Avacu, and you stab the child or the adult in the thigh, and it relieves the symptoms. There are cases where it doesn't work. There are cases where the attack comes back. So that's why you see emergency landings many times when they've used it.
But still, you'd like to have EpiPens on airplanes. I mean, they have defibrillators on many, so why not an EpiPen?
Yes, and in fact, I am part of a coalition of the three largest allergy groups in the United States. And one of the things we're asking for is the auto ejectors on planes. And I think that it's really a public safety issue, because some of the stories that I have are from children or adults that don't know they have a nut allergy. So you still see nuts being served, right, as a snack on many airlines. And so what if it's that person that doesn't have their own auto injector? What then? And then you think about, if I think into the future in my mind, I think, what if my son is a teenager, he's traveling by himself, and he gets exposed, and he passes out, and he can't give himself his own auto injector? Wouldn't I want that flight attendant to be able to recognize the signs of an allergic attack and have something they can do?
Well, but I'm going to argue the other side, though, which American seems to be doing. American doesn't serve peanuts, but it won't take any other steps to address nut allergies. They will not make an announcement. They won't provide buffer zones. And they make the point that others might agree with, that it gives a false sense of comfort. They really can't tell if somebody has peanuts. It's an airplane, after all. It's not, you know, a prison. They can't tell. And so why should they give you the false sense that you will be safe if you won't?
Great question. This is a lot of the argument that is thrown our way. But you see, as a food allergy parent, no one can guarantee your environment. And I can guarantee you that even if you tell me that you're not serving nuts and you're going to make an announcement, I'm not going to think the environment is safe. But I'm going to mitigate my child's risk. And that's all we're looking for, is risk reduction. When you tie our hands
effectively, which is what American does. And I also have several stories on my website and stories that have been told to me of families thrown off American or threatened to be thrown off for even asking for the announcement or telling the rows in front and behind them. You know, when you start having conversations like that, it doesn't make the environment guaranteed. But I have a story of a college student that has an anaphylactic allergy. Someone sat next to him on an airline that doesn't allow announcements and opened up a trail mix and the nut flew up in his nose because it was just one of those freak things where you open the bag and he went into anaphylaxis. Now, something like that, when you are allowed to have an announcement and tell the people around you, is preventable. So it's not that, you know, I don't expect anyone to police other passengers, but when you walk on a plane and they're telling you right away, you can't get on early. So you're like scrambling, you know, while there are a million people in the aisle and you don't know if you're cleaning properly. And as I said, the nut protein is particularly robust. You can't tell the people around you, so they can't read your mind. And then, you know, you just get disdain and insults from the crew, which happens a lot. You know, then you can't fly. You know, the Air Carrier Access Act was created with the intention of allowing all people with disabilities to fly and fly safely.
That's Leanne Mandelbaum. She is, as you've been hearing, an advocate for airline passengers with nut allergies, including her son, and her website is nonuttraveler.com. She has some legislation pending. We'll follow this story. Leanne, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And by the way, that legislation pending in the Senate would require airlines to carry EpiPens or other so-called adrenaline injectors on all flights. But should peanuts just be banned? I'm thinking I'm not going to bring them anymore. It's not worth the risk. But we'd love to hear your thoughts. HereAndNow.org.
Imagine spending an entire day in a tiny room with no windows. Make it a week or a year or even a decade. In California, a Pelican Bay State Prison, some inmates have been held in solitary confinement for more than 20 years, and that practice may be coming to an end. Lawyers for plaintiffs in a federal class action lawsuit are announcing today they have agreed to a settlement with the state. Reporter Michael Montgomery has been covering this story for years. He is with Reveal. That's a show from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Lisa. Nice to have me on the show.
Thanks for being on the show. We're going to hear first from a clip that you did in a story that you had in a story in 2013. This detailed a hunger strike by prisoners at Pelican Bay. This clip is of a prisoner talking about what the solitary confinement that he endured was like. He was held in isolation for more than 15 years.
Being in the cell by yourself with all that time, if you're not doing nothing, yeah, your mind going to start playing games on you. You need to occupy your time. You need to do something creative. You need to feel good about yourself, because if you don't, it's like falling off an airplane without a parachute.
Michael Montgomery, what access to the outside world does an inmate like that one in solitary confinement have during the course of one day?
Well, as you mentioned, at Pelican Bay Prison, which is the highest security lockup in California, they really don't have access to the outside world. The inmate spends 22.5 hours of the day in his cell. He is let out of that cell through these automatic gates and is allowed to go into an adjacent room, which they call an exercise yard, but it's actually really inside. And the inmate is allowed to exercise there for about an hour and a half. They are also allowed to shower about three times a week. That's pretty much their day, at least until recently. And as you pointed out, you do have these kinds of prisons elsewhere in the country, sort of supermax prisons. What has distinguished California until recently was the length of time that some inmates have been kept in these prisons, upwards of 20 years, sometimes 25 years. I've met men who were at Pelican Bay since the prison opened in 1989.
And what kind of crime would get someone sentenced to that amount of solitary confinement?
So these are prisons within the prison. You're not sentenced to these types of lockups. You are placed there by the Department of Corrections, usually, at least until recently, on allegations that you were affiliated with a prison gang. And there are some notorious prison gangs in California. The problem is that the types of evidence the Department of Corrections could use against an inmate to put him in solitary, or sometimes her, could be very thin. A book inscribed with the name of another inmate, another inmate who might be considered a prison gang member, that could be, and in fact, some cases was considered affiliation. And I met an inmate who had been held in isolation purely because he had this type of a book.
The class action lawsuit that is involving a settlement with the state, can you tell us what that's all about, what was announced today?
Yes. So just, you know, earlier today, we got an announcement from the plaintiff's attorneys that they had settled this case, which was a class action lawsuit focused on this prison at Pelican Bay. And essentially what the attorneys are saying is that the state has agreed to move hundreds, possibly thousands of inmates out of these lockdown facilities back into more regular prison cells, and also to put a really strict limit on the amount of time that inmates could be held in these isolation or in solitary confinement. They're talking about moving 1,500 to 2,000 inmates out within the next year. And also the attorneys are saying that any inmate who has spent more than 10 years in one of these units will be moved out, what they are saying immediately. The other thing is what they are saying moving forward is that there will be special units within the general population, that is places where guys can get outside on exercise yards and do programming, where they will house inmates who are high risk, who might be in prison gangs, who might be active in various criminal activities, but they will not necessarily place them in solitary unless they have done something very serious. And that is definitely not what had been the practice earlier. All that said, California has been in implementing reforms over the last few years. So from the perspective of the Department of Corrections, they are saying this is simply speeding up the reforms they had already begun.
But it sounds like solitary confinement under this agreement will not be entirely eliminated in California.
Correct. I think, first of all, the state says it does not practice solitary confinement. It refers to these units as segregation units. Yes, some inmates will be kept in these. There would be more due process. The maximum amount of time an inmate can be held will be reduced. But no doubt there are some very notorious prison gang leaders who will remain in some of these special units, perhaps not as long as they would have under the earlier policy.
Okay. Thank you very much. Michael Montgomery of Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Nice to speak with you, Michael. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.